Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
The New Statesman.
Hello, I'm Freddie.
And I'm Anoush.
And this is the New Statesman's Politics Podcast. On today's episode, Anoush and I have swapped seats, and I'm going to be asking her about a recent reporting trip to Port Talbot and how these steelwork closures will affect Wales and Labour's green agenda. Hello, I'm Freddie Hayward, political correspondent, and joining me in the studio, just back from Wales, is Anoush Shakellian, Britain editor.
Hi, Freddie.
Hello, how are we doing? So how was your trip, Anoush?
Yeah, it was interesting. So for our listeners who haven't been following this story, the two blast furnaces at Port Talbot Steelworks are going to be closed by the owner, Tata Steel, which is an Indian firm, and to be replaced with an electric arc furnace, which is the way that you make steel in a greener way.
Right.
But in the process of making this change, 2,800 jobs are forecast to be lost. And so I went to go and speak to the steel workers there who are about to lose their jobs and find out what they think of the way that they've been treated, but also, you know, the wider context of this green transition.
Mm. I mean, because it's dominating the news in many ways, isn't it? It's in Stephen Kinnock's constituency, who's a Labour shadow minister. Mark Drakeford, the First Minister of Wales, has complained about the fact that Rishi Sunak won't speak to him about it. So we've seen it over many years that Port Talbot's sort of been this totemic project that's required government funding, but also is trying to modernise and adopt new green practices. So where does this fit in the broader story, Anoush, of Port Talbot and also that industrial debate within the UK?
Yeah, so you're right. So closure has sort of hung over, yeah. Or the prospect of closure or job losses has hung over Port Talbot for a long time. I went to go and cover it in 2016 as well. I went round with Carwyn Jones, who was then the First Minister of Wales, when Tata Steel was threatening to pull out of British Steel completely because of, you know, cheap Chinese imports, and it just wasn't, you know, the return on the investment for it. It didn't feel that it was viable. And also, you know, this is in the context of South Wales, which has been deindustrialised, yeah, since Thatcher's day. People still mention the loss of the coal mines there. And it's, you know, a huge part of identity in South Wales, both the industrial heritage, but also what's been done to the communities there. I mean, when I was speaking to someone who runs a sort of breakfast van, which serves the steel workers, and she's been there for 35 years, she was saying that it would be apocalyptic if blast furnaces at the steelworks closed for the town, for her business, and for the wider South Wales economy as well, because a lot of people, even if they don't work in the steelworks themselves, have you know, businesses related to it. Either they're contractors that serve parts of the steelworks, or, you know, they run the corner shop which a steel worker drops into when he's driving to work every day. You know, someone that I spoke to said, I pick up my paper and my milk from a corner shop on the way, and I won't be doing that anymore if I'm not driving to work anymore. Mm. And so there's a big knock-on effect. Unite reps suggested to me that it could, you know, it could add up to the 10,000s of jobs that are affected. So it has huge ramifications for people's lives. And it really does call into question how the government and how Labour intend to transition over to a greener economy, because it looks like inevitably there will be some losers from that. And if communities like Port Talbot start being devastated by these decisions, then is there going to be a public backlash to it?
And what's the government said? Because they've pointed to the fact that they've invested lots of money in Port Talbot before, but what are they saying now?
Yeah, so now they've given $500 million to Tata for this transition. And Labour essentially are framing this as you've given this money to this company to make 3,000 jobs redundant in Britain with no proper strings attached. And the consensus seems to be from people who know about this is that they had the figure first and built their offer around that figure. So it's basically like, you know, we can offer this much and no more. Mm. Whereas Labour, $3 billion into green steel investment as part of their green prosperity plan. And so they've got sort of bigger money to throw at Port Talbot or at Tata. But again, you know, is that enough? You know, I was speaking to steelworkers who were saying they didn't think Labour was offering enough. And they can't promise to keep to reopen these blast furnaces if they close before they get into government, because apparently it's very difficult to reopen the furnaces. So I was speaking to Stephen Kinnock, who, you know, he doesn't work on energy policy, but he's on Labour's front bench and he represents this constituency. And, you know, he was saying what we're saying to Tata is don't make any decisions now, wait for us to get into government, rather than an outright promise that we would reopen them even if they close.
After the break, we'll discuss whether Labour can keep people on board with their green energy plan. If you're subscribed to The New Statesman, you can get all of our episodes ad-free on the New Statesman app. You can get it both on iOS and Android. Just search for New Statesman on the App Store or Google Play Store. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Labour's broader policy for the country in general, but also its economic strategy, is founded on this $28 billion
green
prosperity plan, which we know has come under so much scrutiny, and they've rolled back quite a few times and diluted it over the past few months. They basically say that we're going to keep the overarching aim, which is to decarbonise the energy system by 2030, even if that means we don't spend $28 billion. But when it comes down to the nitty-gritty of on the ground policy decisions, that money, once you add it all up, makes a massive difference, doesn't it? Whether or not they achieve the overarching stated goal of 2030, there's the question alongside that of whether the places like Port Talbot are going to get the money.
Yeah, well, I've spoken to people close to that part of the policy side of things in Labour who have basically said, you know, this is a good story for us to tell because we can sell that investment that, you know, they've been slightly swaying on. I mean, the $28 billion figure, they really don't want to say that out loud in public. And I think they're under instruction not to use the number. But in this case, they can say, well, Labour has this plan. We can guarantee that, you know, Tata, don't do anything now. Wait till we get into government. And here's our plan, you know, a proper plan for investment rather than the government throwing like a small chunk of taxpayers' money at you to do whatever you want with. But I think, you know, that's a positive view of it. But on the other side, I know this is happening under the government's watch, but is it more grist to the argument that net zero is leaving sort of ordinary people behind and having a real financial impact on people's lives, which, you know, the Conservatives have been trying to use, especially since that ULEZ by-election, even though, you know, that policy isn't necessarily related to net zero in quite
planet,
a direct way.
Yeah.
There's already been op-eds in right-wing papers saying this shows the sort of the betrayal of people under the name of net zero. So I do think that is a vulnerability for Labour as well.
Well, this is one of the problems, isn't it? How you keep people on board during the transition. I think people are speculating at the moment that the large insulation programme that Labour have said will be at the top of their priorities will inevitably entail people's houses being ripped apart.
Yeah.
It'd be very intrusive. There's also debate over, you know, how you have domestic heating changes. And we sort of yet to get to those things and we're yet to see the reaction. Now, some people might point to something like ULEZ, which, as we say, is not really a climate change policy. It's more of a health policy. But it was sort of framed in a way of intruding on people's personal lives for some environmental outcome. And I think it's quite interesting, isn't it, that we had so much debate for many months in the lead up to its introduction. And then once it was introduced, there's not been that much backlash, I think, because once people realised that it only affected quite a small number of people. Can't really say the same about home installation, which they hope affects everyone. So I think you're right, Anoush, the debate is going to shift in the next few years if Labour are going to be successful in implementing these plans.
Yeah, and it's worth saying, actually, that the workers that I spoke to, they weren't cynical or sceptical about the green transition. They want to have cleaner energy. They work in this plant. I went round the plant. You can smell it. It gets into your nose, into the back of your throat, you know, the coke burning, which they need to use to create the steel. It's really unhealthy. A black cloud sort of hangs over these works. And then, you know, when you drive further out away from them, then suddenly like a little bit of blue sky was shining through. So, you know, they're, it's dirty work and they like the idea of cleaner energy and a green transition. Mm-hmm. And they've got those specialist skills that they can use in different sort of manufacturing purposes. So they're not against it, but I think what they were saying is what they want to see. They feel completely betrayed by the company, first of all, by the government as well, which they feel is sort of chucking their jobs under the bus. And they do have optimism for a Labour government to do it differently. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, it takes fewer workers to man an electric arc furnace than it does the two blast furnaces. So there are going to be jobs that need to be redistributed elsewhere. And it's up to Labour to make the argument that they would be able to do that in a more just way than is happening at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of sums up the idea that, you know, rarely happens, I think, but that politics and policy, they collide and they come together. Labour has to keep people on board with this. And I think it's interesting that they've, as we just said, they've sort of dropped the 28 billion figure, which doesn't necessarily change the policy. It's just a political manoeuvre. But they've also adopted in one of their campaigning documents recently the new sort of slogan, switch on Great British Energy. Yeah. And we had some polling last year which basically said that the Green Prosperity Plan, as an idea about, you know, investing in the green economy, was genuinely quite popular, but it also had a large minority who were opposed to it, whereas a publicly owned renewable energy company like Great British Energy was extremely popular. It's one of the most popular policies. Yeah. So they've sort of switched towards prioritising that in terms of their messaging. Now, whether that means necessarily that the policy is going to change, I think, is a different question. But leading up to the election, at least, we're going to see them not talk about the 28 billion and talk about Great British Energy.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. I mean, I've sat in focus groups when that Great British Energy policy has been presented to people and it always goes down really well. So I think it's right for them to sort of frame their energy reforms around that policy because it is popular. And again, I think one of the things that came up while I was reporting, which is a question for Labour as much as it is for the Conservatives and also for unions too, is what kind of economy does Britain want to be? You know, the government seems to be quite happy for Britain no longer to be a country, you know, the only one in our league of countries not to be making our own steel anymore, because these plans would mean that we wouldn't make virgin steel. I mean, in the context of the sort of conflicts that we see around the world and the kind of some of the bellicose rhetoric that we see from our ministers, it does seem quite odd that they're happy to sacrifice that. But also, you know, is there an undue nostalgia for manufacturing in British politics? And that's something I thought Stephen Kinnock, when I spoke to him, was really interesting on this, because he said it so many times. I think he said it about four times when I was speaking to him. He doesn't want to be sentimental or nostalgic about these kind of industries. He wants them to be seen for what they are, or what he was arguing they are, which is, you know, extremely cutting edge, high tech, high skilled things that can be taken into the future, rather than, you know, harking back to a past that really doesn't exist in Britain anymore. I mean, it was interesting because the workers were showing me around all the land that will eventually be sold off for the Freeport that's planned for Port Talbot, which is the post-Brexit policy for these sort of deregulated areas of industry. And they were saying probably some of our apprentices who we've been training up since they were 16 are going to end up working in Amazon warehouses here. So, you know, that is the direction that the government has chosen for the economy. So I think, you know, you've got to be quite wary of politicians being nostalgic for a sort of manufacturing Britain when that is the reality.
Yeah, we saw the Resolution Foundation pick up on this recently in their sort of big totemic report. They essentially made the argument that if Labour or the government in general wants the country to grow, they need to recognise the fact that the UK is, in general, a service-based economy.
Yeah.
We can't really have this nostalgia, as you say, or this sort of, you know, harking back to a time or trying to rebuild a time where manufacturing was key and that was our key export. No, our key export at the moment is services. So they've, for instance, took the example of Manchester and they said, OK, well, if we want Manchester to grow as a city economy, well, first of all, we need to massively increase residences in the town centre, and we also need to bring in those huge service providers that are mostly based in London to Manchester, because that's the only way that we can increase productivity. So that I agree. There's sort of that recognition, it sounds like, from Stephen Kinnock and others, that you can't be nostalgic about it. But it sounds as well that Port Talbot isn't necessarily representative of the UK economy in general, when I can't remember the figure, but it's something like, you know, 80% is service-based. Thanks so much for listening. If you'd like to submit a question for us to discuss on a future podcast, you can do so at newstatesman.com/youaskus. If you're listening on Spotify, just scroll down on the episode page and type your reply. Or if you're watching on YouTube, you can leave a question in the comments. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Freddie Hayward, and my colleague Anoush Shakelian. We'll be back tomorrow to answer your questions in our next episode, You Ask Us. Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.